morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's date of February 4th has a few historical near parallels to what is currently occurring in the USA. On February 4th, 1789, George Washington was elected the first president of the United States. On February 4th, 1861, the Confederate States of America were formally formed with Jefferson Davis as its first president. Drop back a few centuries and a couple of days. On February 2nd, 1494, Christopher Columbus begins enslaving Native Americans, a horrible prologue to U.S. history. A somewhat eerily mirror-like, in the first year of this new millennium, 2000 CE, Slobodan Milosevic refused to vacate the presidency of Yugoslavia after having been defeated in an election. A mass nationwide protest landed him in prison for abuse of power, corruption, and embezzlement. He was later tried for war crimes, but died in prison. Donald Trump is on the other side of the same mirror, with slight but pertinent dissimilarities. Despite his howls that his re-election to the American presidency was stolen from him, Trump's campaign managers have concluded after studying the vote numbers that he did indeed lose the election, and it was from his failure to combat the coronavirus pandemic that has killed nearly 500,000 Americans, with no end yet in sight. Despite Trump's pompous declaration that his role in the pandemic was akin to a wartime president, quote unquote, his decision early on was to debunk and deceive while shirking his responsibility as president to lead the nation in its mortal struggle to conquer the plague. Although the second impeachment of Donald Trump, which begins this next Tuesday, February 9th, is essentially for inciting the attack and trashing of the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. by homegrown insurgents who claim to be patriots, perhaps it might make more sense that he be impeached for his dismal failure to protect Americans from the coronavirus, which has been the death of so many citizens. As extremely violent as the Capitol insurrection was, its death toll was half a dozen compared to the hundreds of thousands who have so far died from COVID-19. Even comparing the sick from the injured of both grim episodes is wildly out of scale. This notion is based on the fact that a president's single most imperative job is to protect the nation from disaster, foreign or domestic. And in this instance, a virtual tsunami of microbiotic genocide that is worldwide as well as domestically spawned. Instead of responsibly organizing the defense against plague, Trump instigated a rebellion against necessary strictures and ultimately against democracy itself in his demented delusion he was ordained to be president for life. His contemptible refusal to lead the nation against the corona pandemic is Trump's ignominious legacy that Lincoln once said would follow a president down to the last moment of history. Perhaps the worst failure of presidential leadership in the country's history, it was a deliberate strategy to avoid presidential responsibility on Trump's part for the basic reason he is incapable of being responsible or trustworthy of anything except his neurotic narcissism. Trump's major concern was re-election and preventing the economy from plunging as a result of the pandemic, which he thought would drastically affect his campaign. Consequently, Trump muzzled news in response to the pandemic's incursion into the USA, disregarded advice of medical experts, and disdained scientific research into the disease, blaming it as the China virus. He defied the most basic precautions to prevent spread of the plague, such as wearing masks in public and avoiding crowds and crowded places and events. Trump's initial reluctance to quarantine and shut down American society was coupled by his impatience to rapidly reopen it again for business, incessantly more publicly concerned with the Wall Street Daily Dow numbers than the count of sick and dying from the coronavirus inflicted upon his erstwhile voters. From his initial impatient pomposity that he alone had the authority, when somebody is president of the United States, the authority is total, he declared, Trump readily switched the onus to the states, declaring to governors, you are going to call your own shots, shunting responsibility onto them. Blaming the states seemingly gave Trump an excuse to not have a national comprehensive response, yet he consistently claimed that his leadership was defeating the virus. We have met the moment and prevailed, he announced on May 11th last year. Trump's virulent criticism and ridiculing of wearing masks and social distancing as signs of weakness led to multiple deaths of his own cohorts, as did his persistently egomaniac rallies, which escalated the spread of the virus wherever he appeared. And Trump spent what might have been valuable public media medical information seminars dissing the practical advice and touting quack cures such as injecting bleach. When lockdown states resisted his calls to prematurely reopen, primarily states with Democratic governors, Trump encouraged armed right-wing so-called militias to liberate, quote-unquote, the recalcitrant states. States that rushed to reopen from lockdown at Trump's insistence, with mostly Republican governors, had the worst surges in plague contagion. Trump has shown little sympathy or even acknowledgement for the diseased, dying, or dead. He only sees through the lens of his political fortunes, one critic said. Nothing else counts. And as one writer observed, the COVID epidemic has revealed Trump as not only incapable of true leadership or responsibility, he is simply outmatched and eager to shift the blame, quote unquote. While the U.S. has led the world in plague deaths the past year, Trump has led the world in the production of alibis, Michael Gerson wrote for the Washington Post. Trump's failures of wisdom and judgment have imposed massive, tragic costs on our country, Gerson said. In essence, Trump failed to warn the American people about the virus or to mount a pandemic response equivalent to the deadly danger. He retreated instead to his own personal grievances and obsessions, in particular his re-election campaign, which prompted his only real interest in the pandemic, that it might endanger his presidency, and that was just about the only thing he was right about. His indifference to the national emergency and resulting tragedy was the direct reason he lost a second term, despite his malicious and phony blustering that it was stolen from him. Trump had himself concocted his own defeat by eliminating medical programs set up to warn, track, and treat epidemics. He made cuts in the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institute for Health. He withdrew the United States from the United Nations World Health Organization right in the midst of the pandemic's invasion of this country. A Washington Post editorial summed up Trump's failings in response to his mandate as president. From the start, Trump squandered valuable time silence public health experts and scientists, politicized the regulatory agencies, abandoned a concerted federal response, botched diagnostic testing, lifted restrictions too early, and engaged in deception, illusion, and confusion that left the American people fatigued and divided. And that was the Washington Post. Perhaps Trump's most infamous illogic was when he said, if we stop testing for the virus right now, we would have very few cases, if any. Trump downplayed the devastation of the pandemic from the start, saying it would soon disappear like a miracle. If indeed the U.S. passes on indicting Donald Trump for criminal negligence and deception in regard to the pandemic and its horrific cost in lives, perhaps he ought to be dragged before the world court for crimes against humanity and willful negligence of even the most basic human rights to life. Ironically, the aforementioned deposed president of Yugoslavia, Slobodan Milosevic, was the first head of state put on trial at the World Court, which had been established by the United Nations in The Hague. Milosevic died of a heart attack in prison while conducting his own defense. And that was something I wrote. And now, by Robert Reich. Why Republicans won't agree to Biden's big plans and why he should ignore them. If there were ever a time for a bold government, it is now. COVID, joblessness, poverty, raging inequality, and our last chance to preserve the planet are together creating an existential inflection point. Fortunately for America and the world, Donald Trump is gone, and Joe Biden has big plans for helping Americans survive COVID and then restructuring the economy, rebuilding the nation's infrastructure, and creating millions of green jobs. But Republicans in Congress don't want to go along. Why not? Mitch McConnell and others say America can't afford it. We just passed a program with over $900 billion in it, grossed Senator Mitt Romney, the most liberal of the bunch. Rubbish. We can't afford not to. Fighting COVID will require far more money. People are hurting. Besides, with the economy in the doldrums, it's no time to worry about the national debt. The best way to reduce the debt as a share of the economy is to get the economy growing again. Repairing aging infrastructure and building a new energy-efficient one will make the economy grow even faster over the long term, further reducing the debt's share. No one in their right mind should worry that public spending will crowd out private investment. If you hadn't noticed, borrowing is especially cheap right now. Money is sloshing around the world in search of borrowers. It's hard to take Republican concerns about debt seriously when just 4 years ago they had zero qualms about enacting one of the largest tax cuts in history, largely for big corporations and the super wealthy. If they really don't want to add to the debt, there's another alternative. They can support a tax on super wealthy Americans. The total wealth of America's 660 billionaires has grown by a staggering $1.1 trillion since the start of the pandemic, a 40% increase. They alone could finance almost all of Biden's COVID relief package and still be as rich as they were before the pandemic. So why not a temporary emergency COVID wealth tax? The real reason Republicans want to block Biden is they fear his plans will work. It would be the Republicans' worst nightmare, all the anti-government claptrap they've been selling since Ronald Reagan will be revealed as nonsense. Government isn't the problem and never was. Bad government is the problem, and Americans have just had 4 years of it. Biden's success would put into sharp relief Trump and Republicans' utter failures on COVID, jobs, poverty, inequality, and climate change, and everything else. Biden and the Democrats would reap the political rewards in 2022 and beyond. Democrats might even capture the presidency and Congress for a generation. After FDR rescued America, the Republican Party went dark for two decades. Trumpian Republicans in Congress have an even more diabolical motive for blocking Biden. They figure if Americans remain in perpetual crises and ever-deepening fear, they'll lose faith in democracy itself. This would open the way for another strongman demagogue in 2024. If not Trump, a Trump impersonator like Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, or Donald Trump Jr. If Biden is successful, America's faith in democracy might begin to rebound, marking the end of the nation's flirtation with fascism. If he helps build a new economy of green jobs with good wages, even Trump's angry white working class base might come around. The worst kept secret in Washington is Biden doesn't really need Republicans anyway. With their razor-thin majorities in both houses of Congress, Democrats can enact Biden's plans without a single Republican vote. The worry is Biden wants to demonstrate bipartisan cooperation, and that's a quote, and may try so hard to get some Republican votes that his plans get diluted to the point where Republicans can get what they want. Failure. Biden should forget bipartisanship. Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans did not give a hoot about bipartisanship when they and Trump were in power. If Republicans try to stonewall Biden's COVID relief plan, Biden and the Democrats should go it alone through a maneuver called reconciliation, allowing a simple majority to pass budget legislation. If Republicans try to block anything else, Biden should scrap the filibuster, which now requires 60 senators to end debate. The filibuster isn't in the Constitution. It's anti-democratic, giving a minority of senators the power to block the majority. It was rarely used for most of the nation's history. The filibuster can be ended by simple majority vote, meaning Democrats have the power to scrap it. Biden will have to twist the arms of a few recalcitrant Democrats, but that's what presidential leadership often requires. The multiple crises engulfing America are huge. The window of opportunity for addressing them is small. If ever there was a time for boldness, it is now. And that was by Robert Reich, why Republicans won't agree to Biden's big plans and why he should ignore them. Robert Reich is a former U.S. Secretary of Labor. He is professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few, and the Common Good. His new book, The System Who Rigged It, How We Fix It, is out now. And he is a columnist for Guardian US. And now, Black History Month starts with an idea of reverse migration, at least as visualized by Charles Blow, a New York Times columnist who is among the best American newspaper writers. Mr. Blow, who is Black, has written a book proposing the idea of Blacks returning to the South where their American roots are. The book, The Devil You Know, was reviewed for the Washington Post by Carlos Plazada, which is now. And the review is called A Call for Another Great Migration, this one in reverse, by Carlos Plazada. Mobility, with its promise of reinvention, is the constant allure of America. Immigrants come for opportunity, workers move for jobs, families pack for fresh starts. This motion runs through our history, mythologies, even our literature. Americans are always going west, lighting out for the territory, or longing for the warmth of other suns. For New York Times columnist Charles M. Blow, however, those suns have gone cold. The great migration of Black Americans from the Jim Crow era South to the North and West, 6 million people uprooting and remaking their lives over six decades, a mass movement spanning much of the 20th century, was one of the nation's most defining social and cultural transformations. Yet, in The Devil You Know, Blow wants a do-over. The initial benefits of the Great Migration have given way, in many ways, to a stinging failure, he writes, pointing to the perpetual oppression of brutal police tactics, housing discrimination, resurgent white nationalism, and the political powerlessness African Americans endure in their new climes. Black people fled the horrors of the racist South for so-called liberal cities of the North and West, Blow wrote, trading the devil they knew for the devil they didn't, only to come to the painful realization that the devil is the devil. Blow's solution is yet one more migration, but in reverse. He is a Louisiana native who recently relocated from New York to Atlanta, and he wants more Black Americans to follow his path. The descendants of the Great Migration should return to the South, he argues, and they should do so in numbers so great that Black Americans become a racial majority in various states. Quote, a contiguous band of Black power that would upend America's political calculus and exponentially increase Black political influence, unquote. Blow describes his idea as big and audacious and grand and revolutionary, and many additional adjectives making clear his pride and confidence. Yet this is not a fully developed proposal, more like a rough thought experiment stretched into book form. He says the reverse migration should be intentional and strategic, but the strategy is only partially laid out, reflecting a simplified interpretation of history, one in which counterfactuals are taken as given and sheer numbers are assumed to overpower politics, power, and entrenched prejudice. Just as with the Great Migration itself, Blow's pitch involves both push and pull. He cites the balkanized housing and education segregation in supposedly diverse northern cities, where racism is merely once removed and egalitarianism is a flimsy disguise for white supremacy. White people in destination cities, Blow writes, are committed to the same control over the Black body to which the law has been dedicated in this country from the beginning, a strategy that the modern North has adapted from the historical South. And that historical South, in his estimation, is changing. Blow reports that the roughly 1,200 majority Black cities and towns in the United States, more than 1,000 are in the South, already constituting a country within a country, a new Africa in America, he wrote. He points with excitement to the proliferation of young, innovative Black mayors and Black police chiefs in such southern towns, as well as a thriving Black middle class in many cities. Blow contends that if majority Black populations gain political power at the state level, efforts at criminal justice reform, education overhauls, and even reparations are all become more feasible. A larger Black population, even a majority Black population in select states, may not necessarily lead to the political dominance Blow foresees, especially given his distrust of political coalitions that cross racial lines. The so-called Browning of America could mean that white supremacy is simply replaced by a form of light supremacy, he warns, a contrast to Abrams' calls for alliances with progressive and modern whites as well as non-Black minority voters. For Blow, numbers equal power, and at times he portrays the Great Migration as a missed opportunity to accumulate both in the South. If the Great Migration hadn't taken place, Black people could control or form the majority influence for as many as 90 electoral college votes, more than California and New York State combined, he writes. And if they and other groups voted the same way that they do now, they could have ensured almost every president in the last 50 years was a Democrat. Those are some big ifs. And history is rarely as straightforward as changing one variable and assuming everything else adjusts smoothly. His suggestion that the Republican Party, facing electoral peril in a Black majority South, would be forced to course correct and become a desirable alternative for Black power, and that's a quote, seems quite hopeful indeed. He acknowledges that Black political representation in the South might not grow quickly enough to offset losses in northern cities following a reverse migration. But in the end, the benefit and abundance of Black political power would be to the good, he writes, and his optimism is often more stated than argued. Blow does deserve some credit for voting with his feet, even if missing out on New York salons seems like a net plus. But more important, Blow is in fact making an argument, not just offering a lament of the sort that exhausts him. The Great Migration cleaved the Black community culturally, he writes, between the children of those who left and the children of those who stayed. It is time, quote, to reunite and reconcile these two factions, he argues, to create a space to remember that our trauma history is not our total history. The devil you know reminds that America's mobility has not always meant progress, that alongside the allure of movement are the tears and disappointments that keep us moving, always seeking a new place where we can and must belong. And that was A Call for Another Great Migration, this one in reverse, by Carlos Lozada, a review of Charles Blow's book, The Devil You Know. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer for this program. Tuesday was Groundhog Day, but the incessant wind, rain, and thunder rattled Vernonia Valerie so much she doesn't seem to know or care what season it is. She just wants to burrow in and sleep and not be bothered with prognostications until the sun shines. As for us fevered humans, the plague is about to redouble and diversify. Now is not the time to spring from our burrows and hope for sunshine and flowers. The new president is arraying all possible forces to beat the pandemic, but it has become even more dangerous, replicating in more virulent strains. Think of this as if it were a war, because it is. We are all in our bunkers, and COVID is breaking through the wire. Continue to lock down and mask up as though your life and everyone else's depends on it, because it does.
I'm just going home, quiet like some still day. I'm just going home. It's not far, just close by, though I